Hello, everybody. Today on Transmission, I'm joined by Shanu Mathew, Senior VP and Portfolio Manager at Lazard Asset Management. Shanu looks after more than $1 billion of client capital, and he does it through a sustainable investing lens. He picks companies that aren't just profitable, but are actively shaping a greener, fairer, and safer future. We get into what sustainable investing actually means in practice, and it's not just wind turbines and solar stocks. Shanu explains how companies like HVAC manufacturers, waste firms, and even chip makers are benefiting from the energy transition. And we also dive deep into what public markets are saying about AI and data centers, the staggering sums that are being spent and the bottlenecks in turbines and transformers, and why the race is all about speed to power now. You'll hear us talk about that quite a bit. If you're in energy finance or just curious about how Wall Street is digesting the energy transition, you'll find this conversation fascinating. And for me personally, I really liked how Shanu brought abstract concepts and numbers and made them real stories. So thinking about how decommissioned nuclear sites are going to be brought back online just to serve data centers, things like that. It is incredible. So let's get into it. Hello, Shanu. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, I mean, not as good as you. I can't believe that you've come straight to... So Shanu's with us. He's come straight from ringing the bell at the opening of the stock exchange in New York. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to witness it. I wasn't ringing it myself, but I was at a conference these past few days with the Energy Council, and the team was ringing the bell today. And it was a really cool moment to be on the floor and see that, and kind of the celebration of markets. And it was an eye opening and really cool experience, I think.
So they ring it every day. Was there a listing today? Was it just?
I don't think so. I think there was a listing today. That's part of the reason that the Energy Council team was doing it. I think if there's a brand new listing or a big IPO, like, that team will ring it.
Yeah, confetti.
They still had Cramer and CNBC right there. And, you know, the environment was still pretty captivating regardless.
You know what? I hope one day we get to ring that bell. That will be the day.
Yeah,
although apparently the work starts as soon as you become a public company. That's when the real work starts, right?
Yeah, well, then you have people like me calling on you every quarter.
Yeah, Well, okay, let's get straight into that then. So what do you do in the public markets, Shanu?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Shanu, and I'm SVP and Portfolio Manager at Lazard Asset Management. We are a global asset manager that predominantly focuses on listed public equities. So basically, on behalf of institutional clients, pensions, endowments, people with large amounts of assets, they will invest with active managers such as ourselves. And basically, we're picking portfolios that, in theory, will beat the market and generate a healthy return for our clients. And at the same time, clients have different preferences or styles that they really want to be exposed to. And that's things that my team or our firm will do, and generally whatever flavors you want, whether it's global, US focus, or geography splits or style splits, value, growth, quality, and even just the type of investing. So there's fundamental bottom up, which is folks like ourselves that are, we have analysts and we're looking at stocks individually, or we have, quantitative strategies or systematic strategies that, apply a little bit more software or machine learning or, things of that nature. So it's basically whatever flavor the clients want. We manage money on behalf of them, and we're picking stocks at the end of the day.
So you look after other people's money in funds and then buy stocks in the stock market to get a return for them,
right? Yes, so correct.
Simple Boom. Terms. Perfect. Whose money is it?
Yeah, predominantly we, or at least for my portfolio, I'm a portfolio manager on our U.S. sustainable product. And so basically we have a specific focus, and our thesis is based that companies that contribute to or are assisting or accelerating the move to a more sustainable society by four pillars: greener, fairer, healthier, safer, will outperform over the long term. And so, as you can imagine, a lot of the folks focused on sustainability or those types of strategies are predominantly from the European region. So our clients, most of the institutions we work with are European today. And at a global scale, 80% of the capital that goes into ESG/sustainable investing type products are from Europe. And then increasingly you're seeing pockets from the Americas and APAC and things of that nature. But largely today, whether it's active or passive, that a lot of that's coming from the European region today.
So that's striking. So you said that as if it was common knowledge and obvious, but I've never heard that before. But that reflects the fact that I do a very different job to you. So Europeans in general put more money into ESG and sustainability linked assets versus Americans.
Correct. Yeah, correct. There's definitely regional disparities. I mean, if you rewind like the last 4 years, there was like the growth of ESG globally and things like that. But in terms of like global equity markets, still a relatively small percentage. I mean, like there's, you know, there's some fluffy numbers there that like markets always say like a third of assets are now ESG linked. And if you actually parse through the numbers, it's a lot smaller than that. But at least today, what we've seen is that the European region is generally a little bit more focused on these issues and the frameworks, and we're, you know, pioneering in a lot of ways. And so I think Americans are still figuring out, you know, the different types of strategies they'd like to do with that, and whether they want to be like alpha oriented or integrate some of these sustainability issues. I think strategies like ours will appeal to investors all over the world, but just the pattern of client interest so far, it seems to be, you know, largely driven from the European region.
And so you look after a pool of capital, so $500-600 million, something like that, right?
It'll be $1.5 billion.
$1.5 billion. Okay, yeah. So I'm out a little bit there. So you look after that money, you put it into the stock market and get a return for your clients. And so then you have to choose which companies, and you have to do that through the lens of, you have four very useful pillars there, but ESG and generally, climate-related and sustainability-related activities. So then how do you choose those companies? Because you still got to make money, right? Your job is to make money, but in that world. So start from the beginning. What's the process?
Absolutely. So our process is fundamentally built on what we call two tests for any name that goes in the portfolio. And one's very fundamental driven and one's sustainability driven. And just to be clear, like both these things happen simultaneously and it's driven by the analysts that cover the same stock. So we don't have a model where there's a separate ESG team or things of that nature. The analysts that cover the stocks that have had these relationships for 20 years are the same ones doing the sustainability work, because we find that they're the most in tune with the actual issues and material opportunities or risks at a sector level for individual stocks. So basically, our financial and fundamental test is based on cash flow return on investment. We're basically looking at high quality companies, the top three deciles generally, that generate a really strong cash flow return on investment. And then from a sustainability standpoint, we have a proprietary scorecard that we use that measures companies across products and services, as well as their operations, you know, how they treat their employees, supply chain, resource intensity, resource management, things of that nature. And that ultimately leads to a weighted average score. And that ranges from -5 to +5. Basically, every company in our portfolio has a positive score. We don't own anything that scores negative on that framework. And then we have certain percentages of our allocation that will go towards the highest end of that scoring framework. So that's generally how we think about the world, where, you know, we're looking at things very much from a fundamental standpoint, but we're ultimately trying to also capture that sustainability score. And, you know, where we do best or where we find the best ideas is often when we can tie the sustainability opportunity or risk to the fundamental business. So is it a new product opportunity for them? Is it a new growth of a TAM, so a total addressable market? Will it allow them to accelerate their margin growth? Will it allow for better returns? And ultimately, if we capture those inflection points before the market recognizes them, that allows us to generate healthy returns for our investors.
And so the ideal situation would be that sustainability-linked stocks would return the best returns, right? Is that true?
That's a loaded question, because it depends on how you define that. But I'm glad that you brought that up, because sometimes you say ESG or sustainable fund and everyone assumes that you only invest in solar, wind, and batteries and nothing else. But the way that we look at it, right, is we're broadly diversified. We're looking at incumbent businesses. We're looking at new businesses all the time. And at least in the recent period, and again, you know, all the normal caveats around, if you measure, you know, 1 year, 3 year returns, that could look a lot different than 5, 10, 20 year returns, et cetera. But in recent years, like the, you know, quote unquote pure plays or the most exposed to transition related stocks have actually done not that well. I mean, you can look at it from like the general solar index or the global clean tech index compared to the S&P, which has been tremendous over the last few years. There's been a huge divergence in performance, and that's due to a multitude of things: supply demand mismatch after COVID, high interest rates, you know, political switches in the administration, things of that nature. And so those stocks have actually struggled. And, you know, we've been able to sidestep a lot of that, because often where we find the best opportunity is incumbent businesses with underappreciated tailwinds from sustainability. So that might be an HVAC company that, you know, regulation changes and it drives it to a more efficient use of refrigerants, and this company has a, you know, really dominant position in commercial HVAC. That might be in a waste company that is increasingly, you know, capping their liabilities with flared methane and actually capturing it and selling it back to premium RNG markets. It might be an advanced chip company that is selling increasingly to automotive and industrial, which is both going through electrification, right? So if you have the better chips with a higher content per unit in autos or industrial with robots, that leads to, you know, faster acceleration in top line and or margins. And so, you know, companies that we typically own or have owned in the past, you know, like for example, Trane, Waste Management, Rockwell, all those three examples I just gave to you, are seeing opportunities as a result of the transition. They have really strong incumbent businesses that have been around for decades, but they're also capitalizing on these new opportunities that the secular momentum is allowing.
And the reason why I wanted to start here in this conversation is, I think the public perception is that ESG investing is basically buying wind turbine companies and, you know, stuff in green energy, and that's about it. But the ESG surface area is much, much wider, isn't it? And I just wanted to touch on that. And then before we go any further, so for our listeners, how long do you hold these stocks for generally? When you take a position in one of those companies you talked about, how long do you hold that for? And I know, obviously, it's how long's a piece of string, but roughly speaking.
No, it's a great question, and I'm really glad you harped on that, because our approach is what we call in the industry long only, meaning that we hold stocks, or we buy and hold stocks, and we want to own them for the long term. So typically, when we're underwriting a stock for the portfolio, we generally want to underwrite it for the next 3 to 5 years. We're not in a quarter-to-quarter business that like hedge funds or other asset managers might be, but we're looking to be a long-term partner and steward of capital with long-term ownership. So, I mean, some of the names in our portfolio or even across the firm have been in the portfolios for 5, 10, 15 years, right? If the thesis remains intact and we have a really favorable view of the stock, then we'll continue to own it. And we want to be long-term partners. There's also other stocks, right, that have been a shorter time window. And that could be as a result of a few things, right? Market appreciation. If a stock doubles, all of a sudden the risk reward might be skewed unfavorably. And we're ultimately always looking for the best risk reward management for our clients. And so others, you know, and then also you have situations where your thesis breaks. You might think that a market's a lot bigger or a company's able to fix, you know, their financial productivity a lot sooner than is anticipated. And then when in situations like that, we're ultimately rotating out of names we have less conviction in and then moving toward the ones we have highest conviction in with a good risk reward. So generally like multi-year holding period though.
I just wanted to ground the conversation, because when you hear the word fund, many people think about, you know, screens with lots of graphs on them and algorithmic trading and flash boys and whatever Michael Lewis is going to write next. But you're closer to the kind of Warren Buffett approach, holding and really thinking longer term about these businesses.
I think it's a fair way to put it.
In my simplistic term, obviously it's more complicated than that.
In no way I'm comparing myself to Warren Buffett, but generally that philosophy works a lot better than
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation. So now I want to talk about you listen in on a lot of earnings calls, and all around the public markets, everyone's talking about AI and data centers and infrastructure investments. And so I know you've been spending a lot of time tracking in data center growth and what you're hearing on these calls. Could you just set the scene with how AI and specifically data centers, because we think a lot about energy, how data centers and data center investment is now turning up everywhere? Bit of a leading question, but I think it's a fair one.
No, absolutely. It's all anyone can talk about, to be honest. So I'm tracking it to an excruciating level of detail, but ultimately that's what the market, that's the common dominant narrative right now. And so if you look over the last few years, pretty much since the release of ChatGPT, and you look at the top, 50 stocks in terms of performance, a vast majority of them are levered to AI in some way, whether it's the actual like chips or the hyperscalers that are deploying this in the cloud, or all the way down like infrastructure owners like that own the land or the electrical equipment and things of that nature. So we actually look at things relative like on the index basis, like we've mentioned, up to 40% of the S&P right now is levered to this AI trade. So by virtue of like, if you're in the public markets and you pay attention to the index, which many of us do, you have to have a view on what's going on with AI. And so, we look up and down the supply chain. Our portfolio has different manifestations of the relative, bets that we would want to make in terms of favorable risk reward. But, it goes anywhere from upstream. The hyperscalers are the ones spending the CapEx. And this is like the Googles, Amazons, Metas of the world. Then it goes down to the chip level, which I'm sure NVIDIA, everyone's well aware of now, which is 8% weight in the S&P 500. And then you have the different other GPU providers or ASICs, which we call, which is like the Broadcoms, Marvells, AMDs of the world. You move upstream to the people that provide the cables. There's like opticals, there's copper, et cetera. You go down even further. There's, you know, EPCs that actually build these data centers and do the mechanical, electrical plumbing in there, or the outside the wall power or transmission associated with that facility. And then you have various forms of electrical or cooling equipment. And, you know, there's like the Eatons, the Vertivs, the Trains, et cetera, of the world. And so there's quite a bit to go through. I'm happy to kind of talk about the main themes, but I'd say in general, the last earnings season, so this most recent 2Q, the last month, all the signals are pretty bullish, to be perfectly honest, in terms of just the feedback you're hearing, a lot of pipelines that are being elongated or record levels, really strong order growth, strong visibility. I mean, there's a tech conference going on right now, and CoreWeave, which offers, you know, is more of like a neo cloud type of service model to various providers that want to use AI. And, you know, they're talking about the words insatiable or relentless in terms of demand. And so that kind of gives you an idea of the relative strength of this market right now. That doesn't mean they'll go on forever. I want to be very clear about that. But ultimately, right now, in terms of the signals we saw up and down the supply chain this most recent quarter, it was pretty strong. So happy to dive into a little more detail there.
But if we go to first principles, where is this money coming from? As you said, the first thing you said when you answered that question, which I thought was pertinent, was about CapEx. It's who's spending the CapEx. And it trickles through, right? Whether that's optical cables or transformers or cooling systems. So let's start with the CapEx and these hyperscalers. Well, actually, what's a hyperscaler?
Yeah, so it's ultimately the large tech companies, we said, that have the ability to, you know, stand up a lot of compute very quickly. And it's ultimately their money that's allowing the development of AI more broadly. So, I mean, it kind of depends on the estimates you're using and the numbers, but I mean, just call it round figures. We're probably going to spend somewhere around $500 trillion. And the vast majority of that is coming from, you know, those 4 to 5 companies. And so
$500 trillion when?
This year in terms of CapEx. Yeah. And if you look at the second quarter earnings period, a lot of them actually increased the amount of CapEx they plan to spend in coming quarters and the next fiscal year.
$500 trillion. So this is like 20 nuclear power stations in CapEx.
Yeah.
Maybe even more.
More.
Unless,
more,
you're in China, where you can build them cheaply.
Yeah.
So you're talking, you're tens of nuclear power stations in a year in CapEx spent on data center build out.
Yeah. And that figure is like 50% up year over year. And looking into next year, I mean, you know, there's a law of large numbers that eventually kicks in, but again, it's still staggering in terms of, I mean, look at the different bank estimates. You know, some of them have that number going to $1 trillion in coming years, others have it slowing down, but that just gives you, like, it's eye watering, right? We're talking about the entire GDPs of nations at this point in terms of the level
entire up. GDPs of nations being spent in a year on new data centers.
Yeah, and that's split across chips and physical infrastructure. I'd say, like, at least the last few years, it might have been skewed, you know, 50-50 or maybe slightly towards the actual physical infrastructure because that's longer lead time. But increasingly, it'll be spent on, you know, what we call IT equipment or the actual chips and the servers and stuff going forward.
And I imagine, similar to what we spend a lot of time looking at in the battery world, that a lot of the infrastructure, when you build one of these sites, you can replace the cells, but a lot of the infrastructure might last, you know, many, many decades. And so I assume that data centers are thinking this way. I've heard that the, you know, some of the estimated replacement rate is like 2.5 years, something like that, in some of these chips.
Yeah, the chips' useful lives, there's a huge debate on it, and I don't think anyone really knows the answer to it unless you have a huge fleet of GPUs running and you can kind of look at it day to day. But ultimately, yeah, I think, and from accounting purposes standpoint, a lot of companies point to 4 to 6 years. If you talk to people that actually are deploying these chips, they say it might be closer to 2 to 3 years if you're running them all out. But those will be replaced very, very often. The longer term infrastructure could be in place for 10, 20 years.
Your cables and your transformers, they're going to be there for a while. And so one thing we're trying to get our head around, you know, the whole power industry, which is obviously what we focus our time, is trying to get our head around, is what happens with all this load growth and what that means for the power sector. And so how do you think about that problem when you're thinking about the broad-based effect on the economy?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, increasingly, just given the eye-watering sums of money being invested, AI is increasingly tied to the overall economic picture globally, especially so in the US. I think one of the things that you really introduced that I would love to stress for listeners is that duration mismatch, right? In power, we're typically talking about things on 20, 30, 40-year timelines. And this data center trend, again, ChatGPT came out 3 years ago, right? And so, and we're talking about 2 years on chip timelines and things like that. So there is this really big duration mismatch where utilities often plan for 20, 30, 40 years. And in terms of visibility, I mean, sure, it looks really strong right now. And I just talked about all the optimism around data centers and AI, but who's not to say that that could slow down? And all of a sudden, if you build a power plant that needs to be in service and that the ratepayers are going to pay for over 20, 30 years, all of a sudden, if there's no more demand and no more load growth in 5 years, like that, it creates a really big fundamental mismatch and problem. So that's what's happening across the US and the globe, quite honestly, is just like, how real is this demand cycle? And then how long will it last? So I don't think anyone's debating the level and velocity of dollars today, but it's just like, will that continue? And how long can it continue? Because that is, you know, increasingly a very, very high number. Like even the most profitable companies in the world can only spend so much money, right? And so it ultimately starts to focus on like, what is the incremental source of, you know, CapEx dollars? Like, are the models going to get better? Are there different scaling vectors that they can continue to do? Because if so, then we will ultimately see all these numbers flow into load growth. But there's a really wide range. So, I mean, just to not spend too much time on the numbers, but in terms of the pipeline of activity, like typically with power, if anyone's been a student of history, the power industry is really poor at forecasting. There's a really good chart from S&P that we maybe could link in the show notes. For the last 20 years, if you look at each individual year of the annual power forecast, it always shows up and to the right, and the actual line has been flat. So really, really bad forecasting. And, you know, this time could be different and all these things. And I think there's all fundamental drivers, but historically we overestimate. And then the more challenging part too is that we don't know really how long duration this cycle could be. So in terms of like wide variance of, you know, estimates, for example, we'll use the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab study. Data centers today are, call it 3 to 4% of overall US electricity. And they forecast by 2030, it can be anywhere from 7 to 12%. That's a massive variance in electricity markets. You know, the difference between 7 and 8% is huge and nominal. And we're talking about a range that's literally double, 6 to 12 on the high end. So that gives you a range of why it gives like utility operators or owners heartburn in terms of, you know, if they get this wrong, that's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be paid for. These are, I mean, plants, a gigawatt plus plant is a couple billion dollars, depending on the gen type. This isn't, you know, you can fall asleep and forget about it type of things. Like this will be really profound. And then I think it's also coming at a time politically where electricity bill inflation is becoming a, you know, kitchen table issue. And I wouldn't be surprised if the next few elections have that core to them. And, you know, if we have a lot of load growth, that means electricity bills are going up too. And so it becomes a question of like, who's responsible for it? How much can these tech companies or other users pay for this? And, you know, are we going to feel the impact of it? Like you and I paying our local utility bill.
Yeah, it's a hot potato in the PGM market at the moment, isn't it? Because the democratization of the cost of all these connections is, as you say, I mean, it's such an easy, easy thing to point to politically as to get angry about.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, the broader picture is a bit more complicated. I've got so many questions on this, but coming back to the data center build out for a second, could you just, you had a really good rule of thumb there. So a couple of billion dollars for a gigawatt data center is roughly what you said. Right?
For a power plant. And that is, so a gigawatt data center is actually a lot more than that. So traditional data centers, so like CPU based compute, you can call it for the data center, like anywhere from $8 to $12 million per square foot.
So this is normal cloud stuff, normal. Amazon Web Services. This is what we're all used to, right? This
yes.
is not AI stuff and it's not Bitcoin mining, but we'll keep that out of this for now.
Correct.
So normal cloud, you're saying,
$8 to $12 million per square foot. So call it, you know, $8 billion to $12 billion on a gigawatt data center. Okay. Again, data centers typically aren't sized that big, but they have to be for AI. Now we're moving into an arena where it's typically people will quote you in the $20 to $30 million per square foot range. So a massive leap, right? A gigawatt plant could cost $20 to $30 billion. And actually, if you kind of do the math on the recent announcements, it's suggesting even higher numbers than that. And so that's split across a bunch of things. So that number is fully loaded. So for example, let's just use the 20 just for sake of ease, $20 billion, 10 billions of that is chips and servers, you know, maybe even 60%. And that leaves over like 30% for cooling, electrical, EPC, labor, land, cables, things like that. But that gives you the idea of the scale. Like these are massive projects. And so it introduces a question of, because it's a whole issue about power, and all of a sudden you're hearing about people building behind the meter or their own power stations, and you're wondering, why would someone want to spend a few billion dollars on a power plant? That's a lot of money. But if you're spending 20, 30 billion to get the data center built and all these chips, and again, they only have a useful life of a few years before they, you know, get deprecated or become the older version, you can understand what's at stake in terms of generating a good return. And that's why it's motivating some of this, you know, speed to power or time to power type of thinking.
It's like another Manhattan project, isn't it?
Yes.
It's just enormous and all privately done.
Yeah, I mean, there's different pockets of capital now that are contributing, but it's very, just private driven. I mean, and we're sitting here in New York right now. Meta, if you look at their project for the new data center campuses they have going up, they're going to be bigger than all of Manhattan. I think it was one of the images they showed, just to give you a scale. Like, these are like football field sized, huge facilities. They go for miles and miles.
Let's talk about, so can you pull out a couple of examples? That's a great example. So you're on the earnings calls, you're studying these hyperscaler companies. So you mentioned one, Meta, there with a project bigger than Manhattan. You know, what other crazy things are going on in the market?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think it really is just around this whole theme of how are people bringing this infrastructure faster than the typical timeline. So for the listeners, generally, when you try to request power from utility, that can take anywhere from 3 to 7 years because they need to get the appropriate permitting and siting and things of that nature. So typically, you go through the avenue because you're not in the business of building your own power. Now what we're starting to see in the market is, you know, you're increasingly seeing companies start to procure power on their own terms. So the big hyperscalers now have teams of tens of hundreds, sometimes people procuring energy on their behalf. So we've seen different deals in the market. I mean, just yesterday, you know, a water utility had to put a filing out that, you know, there's a 944 megawatt behind the meter project going up, which is, you know, a massive project that's going to go up entirely behind the meter with the CCGT as the power source. You saw Meta.
Not a private wire. So
that theoretically is going to be private wire because you're not plugged into the utility. It's going to be behind the
meter. Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So behind the meter, meaning you're not plugged into a meter that the utility ultimately bills you for. And so you're starting to see more and more of these announcements. The thing about these is, like, there's a lot of bottlenecks associated with doing so. As you can imagine, like, it's already complex enough to build a massive data center and or a power plant. And when you're combining all these things together, like, it adds on layers of complexity. So you still need to get, you know, you need to have a turbine slot to ensure that you can actually get your equipment. You need to have the appropriate land. You need to have the ability to, you know, lay down your wire, ensure that you have enough space for diesel tanks or backup generation, things of that nature. And so we'll see how many of these actually get built. But in terms of announcements, we're seeing that. You're also seeing other transactions directly with utilities. So Meta, for example, just did a deal with Entergy. They're going to put up a 2-gigawatt data center campus. And they signed a 15-year bilateral deal, meaning that, you know, they're guaranteeing the utility 15 years of a revenue source. And that what that does is that helps mitigate the amount of cost inflation that their ratepayers will pay, right? Because Meta is trying to, you know, pay for their commensurate share of what they're going to need in terms of infrastructure. That created a little bit of a stir because the local substation and some of the wires there needed upgrading, and that will be on the ratepayers, not Meta. And, you know, that created a whole stir. But part of the issue is, if you look into the deal details, is because the amount of capacity Meta will need is so much higher, they need to uprate the lines, but that actually benefits everybody. Like, we have a higher voltage and things like that nature. So there's all these weird nuances.
They're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't.
Exactly. And then you're seeing other deals too, where, like, for example, Microsoft with 3 Mile Island is bringing back a nuclear plant that was previously decommissioned. And that's additional power, right? That's going to a local grid. You're seeing 20-year PPAs on other assets. For example, Meta did that with the Clinton nuclear plant. So there's quite a bit of deals going on.
So nuclear plants coming out of retirement just to power data centers?
In this case, yes. Just to be clear, though, there's only a handful of those that can happen. So I think sometimes people see that and they're like, oh, we can do this everywhere. There's only a handful of plants in the U.S. that are capable of doing so, because they're not far enough along in decommissioning. So that is a very limited source. We'll only have a few of those. But, I mean, you have people talking about new nuclear now and small modular reactor nuclear and stuff like that.
But it's amazing. I mean, I say
dreaming big, I'll say.
I say just to power data centers. I'm not in a disparaging way like that. That's not a good use of power. But, I mean, as a power professional, it's just mind-boggling. And so speed to power is the new thing, right? Rather than speed to market, everything's about time to get your connection or time to power. And you talked earlier about, if you were going to build a data center, you've got to be thinking about supply chain. And you mentioned specifically, I want to just double down on this bit, on turbine slots. So lots and lots of talk and chatter about how turbine manufacturers are totally at capacity. So when you're, this must come up a lot in earnings calls, how are people thinking about getting hold of gas generation turbines?
This has been a really topical headline, as you allude to, and I think people sometimes confuse the fact that there are multiple types of turbines. Oftentimes, when you hear the large turbine providers, so it's like GEV, Siemens, Mitsubishi, there's a global oligopoly. You know, they control, I don't know, call it 70 to 80% of the global market. They talk about long timelines leading into 2028, 2029, 2030 onward. That oftentimes is for a certain type of turbine, right? So that could be like your workhorse CCGT, which is a combined cycle gas plant. But that's different than, for example, like an aeroderivative engine, or a rice engine aeroderivative turbine, or a simple cycle industrial turbine. And those different turbine types across the different providers have different lead times. But generally, you're looking at a few years is the moral of the story. But sometimes that headline goes crazy where it's like, you can't get any type of turbine for 5 years. And that's generally not true. Really, we're seeing that. But you are seeing folks look at access to equipment, because if you can't get something in 4 years, then that time to power question obviously comes into question. So I think what we're starting to see, though, with some of these behind the meter setups is people getting flexible about the types of turbines they'll use, or plugging in a bunch of reciprocating engines together. You're hearing a long time about wacky things from data center developers in terms of people that want to just get power soon. And then this idea that they'll do that for only 2 to 3 years until they can actually get plugged in with the utility. Because building a massive CCGT, again, is a huge project. That takes a few years on its own.
Absolutely.
So if you're doing that, that's a whole different avenue. But a lot of people are trying to focus on this bridge element too, where you're taking these smaller turbines that might be cheaper, easier to get, stringing together a bunch, and then hopefully you can get plugged in a little bit sooner with the utility.
It's funny, I've got this vision of, we have this big problem. Actually, I know it's a problem here in New York as well, catalytic converters being stolen from cars, right? Because you can go and get $100 for selling that. I've just got this vision of, you know, these Airbus planes. You wake up one morning and someone's taken a turbine off it. There's a big shortage. There must be all sorts of weird and wacky combinations that are being considered now. As you say, air-driven turbines and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a funny anecdote, something that helps bring it to life. I haven't seen it. Any validation of it, so take it for a grain of salt. But apparently, XAI is rumored to be importing a power plant from elsewhere in the world, because it's that in terms of backlogs and access to capital, you know, you're not able to get one sooner, that they're thinking about like deconstructing a plant that must be modular in nature from elsewhere in the world and shipping it into the U.S. And I'm talking to data center developers that work in different markets. And if you have an underutilized turbine somewhere, you might be able to move it and get a higher value elsewhere in a different market. So you're hearing about crazy things like that. Like, this is so foreign sounding to me. I haven't been in power as long as decades, but been in it for 10 years enough to see, you know, different cycles and behavior and this type of stuff I haven't seen before. So it just goes to show that the lengths people are willing to go to.
And so one more on the data center craziness, because I think that's the only way to describe it. And also totally rational as well. So what about these other supply chain companies? I know that you know a lot about companies like Eaton, for example, and other infrastructure companies, or they provide, you know, power infrastructure, whatnot. How are they responding to this? You know, transformer manufacturers, and then you've got this, the sideline is you've got the big Made in America movement as well. So all of this coming together, how are they responding to this?
Absolutely. I mean, you're seeing a lot of growth, quite frankly, right? I mean, you mentioned Eaton, which is a big electrical equipment provider in the recent quarter. Off the top of my head, so not memorizing, but I think it was, you know, that 50% revenue growth and 50% order growth as well, I think, in that data center business. You have funk companies like Vertiv, which is, you know, the massive electrical and cooling provider to the data center business, and their trailing 12-month backlog is up 20%, and, you know, record new bookings in the quarter. You have the EPC companies like, you know, the Quantas, Comfort Systems, and et cetera, are subcontractors. But generally, you know, you're seeing really strong, healthy growth in their backlogs. I think for Comfort Systems, for example, like, data centers are a third of their overall RPO, which is, you know, remaining performance obligations, so kind of a backlog type of figure. So you're seeing a lot of folks, you know, ultimately see that they're booking new business. The other big thing, though, is labor is increasingly constrained, and some of this equipment is long lead time. So on the electrical and cooling side, you've seen a lot of capacity come online in the last few years. So people investing in bigger factories, or, you know, opening new lines to manufacture more units. On the EPC side, you can't just create more skilled labor. It takes time, right? It takes a few months. So you're increasingly seeing issues with that, where, you know, folks that actually have a huge workforce or the ability to train up workforce quickly might win more projects. And certain companies that, you know, point to that in terms of their competitive advantage. You're also seeing the you know, the introduction, or like, or at least not an introduction, but increased demand for prefab, which is basically like trying to build you know, certain equipment or parts of a facility in a modular sense. You can just ship it to the site, and that way you don't need to like ship materials and have people assemble it on site. You can kind of do that through a modular or prefab type basis. And you're starting to see that uptake just because there's, you know, so little labor. And again, it's all about the speed to market.
Speed to market, speed to power.
Yeah.
So when you're doing research on these hyperscalers and you're listening to these investor calls, it all feels very America focused. Have I got that right, or is this spreading around the world? You know, European data centers. Are we going to have European data centers at the scale that we're seeing in Virginia, for example?
It's a good question. I'd definitely say it's a global trend, but I'd say it's very driven by certain pockets of, you know, regions right now, the U.S. being one of them. Also, there's the N of one issue where I focus on U.S. equity. So a lot of the companies and commentary I'm pointing to is predominantly U.S. focused. But, you know, some of these companies do sell into other markets and talk about strength. I think ultimately, just to your point, it ultimately comes down to the constraint. Like, what's the key bottleneck? And it is the access to power. And so, you know, the U.S. becomes a main area because a lot of our labs are here. And then, you know, we theoretically are trying to answer the call that bring on power sooner. You saw that with the executive order and the, you know, AI acceleration plan. But you're also seeing other regions, like, you know, for example, China has considerably stronger reserve margins, which is basically a source of how much excess power you have in your markets. And you'll start to see, you know, demand go elsewhere if they can't get power here sooner. You know, European market seems to be strong. A lot of the private capital providers, the big PE shops of the world, really are bullish on growth there. But at least just from a land perspective and cost perspective to get it done, right, it's probably a little bit easier in the US or China than it may be in Europe. Just not knowing that market as close. So definitely a global trend, but I'd say, you know, the bulk of activity is probably heating up in the US and China regions. I forget on a global capacity basis, but I want to say the US is somewhere like 50 to 60% of some of these like high-end facilities. And obviously all the leading labs and models are coming out of the US, but increasingly so China, especially on open source. So that'll definitely start to race. Gear up. But one thing I would also call out for listeners, though, is like the issue of sovereignty is going to really start to play a huge issue soon. You can think about how much data people are putting into these AI machines, and all of a sudden, you know, the US versus China and their geopolitical battle will get increasingly even more important here, where all of a sudden you might start to see a government say, like, you need to have your data, or the data you hold on our consumers needs to be built in the US and not go through a Chinese data center or elsewhere. So it's an important thing to pay attention to.
I've said it before on this podcast. Anybody who knows me knows I'm a bit of a Bitcoin bug, and which might be a controversial thing to say. But one of the things I've just got this idea that even if there is total overbuild out of the data center, so I'm a believer that I think sovereignty of Bitcoin mining will become an important thing over time. I don't know what your opinion is on Bitcoin in general, but that's my belief. And that mining Bitcoin on home turf will become a big political issue at some point in the future. But the equipment that you have for these AI data centers, it's the same equipment that you need to mine Bitcoin, right? Give or take a little bit. And so even if there's overbuild, you know, the optimist in me says, well, even if there's overbuild in this, all of this AI data center infrastructure, if it turns out the bubble bursts, then we'll just use it all for Bitcoin mining, and that's a good thing. That is a good thing if you are one of the very few people who believes that's a good solid future for the world. Okay, let's talk about. I want to come back to you investing in public equities and back to your fund for a moment before we get to your contrarian view. So I want to come on something more forward looking now. Some themes to watch or signals. So what are some of the things you've heard in the public markets recently that you think we should just keep an eye on? Some examples. I know you've mentioned some, but what should we keep a look at?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what I've pointed to is probably what I would continue to point to in terms of just like the, you know, the backlogs and pipelines for these companies, like the pipelines and the book-to-bill ratio for these construction companies continuing going up, because they're probably the immediate beneficiary and the nearest term indication of things are getting built or not. And then upstream on the equipment, which is a little bit longer lead time, are those backlogs still growing? Are they getting elongated? Are they coming in, which is a sign of maybe supply and demand being the same? NVIDIA's earnings calls yesterday, right? And I think if I got the number right, Jensen was calling out for $3 to $4 trillion of compute infrastructure that's going to be spent on, you know, over the course of the next few years. And so if those numbers are true, right, like we were talking about $500 trillion earlier being a huge number, I mean, 3 to 4 is bigger. So I think paying attention to some of those things where, like, you know, these are grand proclamations and seeing if the numbers actually meet the narratives. Because the big thing we're trying to do as investors is, you know, everyone's always selling something, right? And everyone's always talking about, you know, how their chart is up into the right and will continue to go up into the right. And I think ultimately it's putting numbers to pen and paper. Like, does this make sense? And can we actually grow that big? And it's ultimately just doing that exercise of tying that big macro picture to, is that actually happening at an independent company level or on a bottom-up basis?
Okay, now I want to get to, my last two questions. Firstly, is there anything you want to plug for our listeners? We'll put some links to your website and some of the other media stuff you've done in the show notes, but anything you want to plug? And then we're going to get to your contrarian view.
Not necessarily. I appreciate that. I'm definitely always trying to share useful information. And when I do kind of some of these speaking things, it's generally try to educate folks and learn and honestly debate in public. So I think if anything, I'd plug engage me in some type of capacity. If you have different views or you think I'm misunderstanding or misinterpreting something, I'm always looking to, you know, learn more and, you know, update my assumptions on the world.
And so now onto your contrarian view. So what is it that you believe that not a lot of other people believe?
Yeah, I'd say I'm not sure that not a lot of people necessarily don't believe it, but I think it's getting underappreciated relative to the opportunity in front of us is that with these data centers, a lot of times, you know, we've obviously talked about the heating needs and the cooling needs and the electricity use at the chip level. What a lot of people don't realize is a lot of times these chips oscillate in energy use. So you have a data center that can sit idle and be at like a 40% utilization of their overall capacity, and that will spike up to 100% in a matter of milliseconds. And that's largely because of how the chips work today. And I think over time, you know, one of the ways to smooth that out, that's usually not great for a power plant, by the way. Power plants want to run, especially like a gas plant. It's not meant to flex up and flex down. It wants to just run a stable load factor. And so one of the things that you'll see and what you're already seeing at some sites, for example, the XAI one, is batteries are really smoothing that out over. And so I think, you know, there's this almost quote, like cultish or religious battle going on between the solar and storage folks versus gas folks. And, you know, there's a lot of like highlights about gas. But I think in either scenario, you're probably still going to need a lot of storage. Just due to some of the transient workload issues, as they're referred to in the industry. And so you even see that with that project I mentioned earlier in the podcast, the 944 megawatt behind the meter gas generation, that is being paired with storage. So gas and storage there, whereas typically you would think of solar and storage going together. I think storage is going to boom in kind of either respect, just given that transient of workload issues. And as well as you increasingly get, you know, more and more of this load growth. I mean, data centers are strong and pronounced right now, but we still have the electrification of vehicles coming up. We have electrification of industry coming up. And I think, you know, the growing importance of storage will continue to be there. And so I think regardless of even if we build more gas than previously anticipated or as anticipated a few years ago, storage still is going to play a role. And you're seeing that in the growth rates and development plans.
Yeah, it's one of the overlooked things is data centers are assumed to be baseload, and they can behave a little bit differently.
Yeah. I'd say they generally are like a higher load factor, higher baseload, but there are these weird issues where, again, you know, if you're spending billions of dollars, you don't want your equipment to wear out sooner than it should.
And so your take on that is, even with the load of this data center baseload in inverted commas, we're still going to need a lot more storage.
Yes. Yeah. Even if gas is meeting the call, because I think that's a lot of folks are talking about today. And I think that some of the legacy thermal asset, you know, favorites or people that support that often underplay or the role that storage will play regardless.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming to join us on the podcast. It really has been a lot of fun. If you want to find out more about Shanu and the work that Lazard are doing, we're going to put links in the show notes. And I would recommend that you sign up for Shanu's monthly blog, where he shares all things climate investing and public equities and lots of data center power stuff in there, which is great. And thank you for coming to see us in New York. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me and really productive conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.